the Tarrant County Young Lawyers Association President's Podcast. My name is Austin Gardner, and I'm the current president of the TCYLA. The goal of this podcast is to discuss all things legal in Tarrant County, Fort Worth, Texas. Today's topic is Legal Legend Stories, where we take a deep dive into a case of a veteran attorney that they feel made an impact in their career. Today, I'm joined by my guest, James Teal. James Teal graduated from Texas Tech University School of Law, class of 85, beginning in private practice, handling litigation, including Child Protection Services, or CPS, and child welfare, representing parents, and serving as an attorney guardian ad litem for children in CPS cases. He then worked for the Tarrant County District Attorney's Office, beginning in October 1999, and leaving that position as a former court chief of the CPS division in 2015, when he was appointed to the 323rd District Court as an associate judge. He served as an associate judge from January 1st, 2015 until December 31st, 2018, where CPS litigation and juvenile law took up his docket. In 2009, he was awarded CASA of Tarrant County's DFPS Representative of the Year, and in 2017 was awarded CASA of Tarrant County's Scott Moore Award. James Teal now serves as a director and legal consultant to Our Community, Our Kids, also known as OCOK, which is a private organization that serves the purpose and role of CPS in Tarrant County. James Teal, thank you for joining our podcast.
I appreciate you inviting me to participate. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Now, although I have different topics on the President's Podcast, or at least I plan to since it's the first one, I think it's important to have some veterans share the stories that I believe young lawyers can benefit from. Now, before we get into that, I'd just like to have a quick discussion about your journey as a trial lawyer.
Well, I've had a lot of lucky breaks along the way. Right after graduating law school, my very first job was with the Tarrant County District Attorney's Office. As a matter of fact, I was sworn in the day following my passing of the bar. And so you can't get much luckier than that to be hired on by, an outfit that if it's not truly designed to do so, it certainly is an opportunity for a young attorney who is interested in trying to see what kind of trial skills they might have or how to develop those trial skills. I was very fortunate to be hired by the Tarrant County DA's office right out of law school, essentially. So I was able to jump right into actually trying cases as a misdemeanor trial lawyer. And I did a lot of things in the 4 years that I was initially with the Tarrant County District Attorney's Office, from misdemeanor cases to prosecuting juvenile delinquency matters out at juvenile courts. I was in the white collar crime unit for a few years. I was in a regular felony court for a couple of years. And I spent about 4 years in the district attorney's office. And back in those days, in the 80s, that was pretty typical for lawyers to spend about 4 years with the district attorney's office, getting quite a few jury trials under my belt, having the opportunity to, with the district attorney's office, you're usually trying cases with another prosecutor. So you were having the opportunity to watch other lawyers, learn from other lawyers, learn from judges, learn from defense lawyers. So I spent 4 years doing that, and then decided that, which was kind of the normal routine back in those days, to head out and hang my shingle out and try my hand at private practice. So that's what I did. And I think I'd mentioned to you that I recognized early on that it was so important as a young lawyer in trying to determine what direction you really wanted to take, to build relationships with other lawyers, to build relationships with important people in the system, whether that be court coordinators, court clerks, legal secretaries, judges. All of the above are so important for young lawyers to build relationships with and be honest with those relationships. because it is so important for people to befriend you, because you can learn so much about the practice of law, not just from other lawyers, but from experienced folks who are just in the business of the system. And so I tried to take full advantage of that. It's really important, I think, as a young lawyer to use your first years to have other people develop a trust in you, to trust that you're going to do what you say, to trust that you are going to work hard, for other lawyers to trust in what you're telling them about the cases that you're working on. It's just critical. You know, one small mistake, and someone gets a feeling that you cannot be trusted, and that can affect you for the rest of your career. So you have to be careful. You have to be observant in who you're reaching out to hopefully seek mentorships with. And I found that it was really important to, when you're working with cases with other lawyers, start to develop kind of a list of folks that you think you could learn from, and figure out how best you can utilize that. Now, one of the things I did not do is take advantage of things like Tarrant County Young Lawyers Association, Tarrant County Family Bar Association. Those things are critical. Those are great opportunities to reach out to people, figure out who you think you really want to get guidance from, and then do the best you can and hope for a little bit of luck to get those mentors to really help you develop your skills. And that's pretty much what I did for the next, well, for the first 4 years, and then the next 10 years. I was able to try a lot of cases. Of course, in the business of practicing in the criminal law arena, you're going to have a lot of cases. You're going to have the opportunity to have potentially 100 or more jury trials, before you're too far, terribly far into your career. And you can certainly, hopefully, be learning a lot as you're doing that. And you're, of course, assisted if you have the good fortune of having some good mentors to learn from. So I feel very fortunate to have done that. And then when I had practiced in private practice for 10 years, primarily handling criminal cases and juvenile cases and CPS cases, I realized that was what I wanted to do. I wanted to spend my career doing that. I've always felt that I was a pretty good evaluator of myself. I've always declared myself to be my biggest fan and my harshest critic. And I think that philosophy has served me well. And I recognize that I have some level of skill in practicing in the area of criminal defense and CPS litigation. So my good fortune continued after 10 years of private practice. I was able to, there was an opportunity to go back to the district attorney's office. There was a position that had opened up to be the court chief of the what was a little bitty unit of lawyers, CPS lawyers. And I had the good fortune, I think, because I had developed a really good relationship with the elected DA, Tim Curry, and he brought me back. And for the next 15 years, I was able to do nothing but prosecute CPS cases. Now, I didn't have nearly as many jury trials, because that's just the way the system is. You want jury trials, you want a lot of them. Criminal defense is the way to go, or criminal prosecution.
Right.
But I felt like that in the little small group at that time, Austin, there were a total of, believe there would be four lawyers. That was it. I was the lead, and I had three other lawyers. Clifford Bronson was there, Cindy Williams that was there, Missy Pascal was there, and I saw that as an opportunity to maybe try a little teaching as well. Let those other lawyers try cases with me, so that they could have the opportunity, if they wanted it, to see how I tried cases. So that's how I ended up with couple of decades and some change of trying cases as both a defense lawyer, as a prosecutor. And then, you know, fortune smiled upon me again, and I was able to preside as an associate judge out at the 323rd, and was able to preside over what is essentially criminal cases with juveniles, and also preside over CPS cases. So that's kind of my journey that brings me to my current job, which is helping out with our community, our kids, as best I can to hopefully, and I don't know how well I'm doing that, Alston, but hopefully help caseworkers out in understanding what they need to bring to the table as far as CPS litigation.
Yeah, and full disclosure, obviously, a lot of people may not know, but I do also work for the DA's office in the CPS wheel or realm, doing nothing but the child welfare CPS cases. So we work together quite a bit, which is one of the reasons I picked you as one of my first guests, because it's kind of my wheelhouse and I can know what questions better to ask, because you don't know what you don't know. And I think that really, what you don't know, what you don't know is definitely something to highlight as any young attorney, right? Because when you first start to practice the law, you really don't know anything. You know theory and you know law, and it's so important to find those mentors in your life to just teach you what to do. Who do I file this thing with? Who do I go talk to about setting this stuff? How do I, you know, what is this judge like? What kind of objections do I need to not make or make in this course? What are some of the ways that you've found mentors? Or because it's so awkward as a young lawyer, no one's going up to people and saying, "Will you be my mentor?" That just sounds so weird, so funny. It's so important to have those. So how do you find those mentors?
I think that kind of goes back to building those relationships and using the organizations like Tarrant County Young Lawyers Association and other groups to try to build relationships, to get those more senior lawyers to be open to letting you be a part of their professional lives. It's hard, and it does, it requires work. It requires, luck, but I'm kind of like you. It's so hard to ask someone to be a mentor, and then how to make that really productive. You know, I see a lot of people looking for people who will let them sit in on a trial with them. And that's great. There's certainly an advantage to watching any trial and watching it up close. But that is no substitute for getting with a lawyer and finding an experienced lawyer who will let them watch how a case develops. And that means getting on as early as you can in a case, not on the day that a jury trial starts, but early on so that you can see how other lawyers figure out early on in a case how they are going to develop their theory. As a matter of fact, I know we don't have a lot of time, but the two lawyers that after about 2 or 3 years, I recognized these people really know what they're doing in the courtroom were Jeff Kearney and Tom Hill. And I was fortunate to be on the appointment wheel. And that's a good way to get experience, because oftentimes courts on serious cases will appoint you as a co-counsel. And that's exactly what happened to me. And that's how I developed some mentorships with lawyers who got a look at what I could do. And then they continued mentoring me after that. Matter of fact, I was hired by one of them. Tom Hill hired me into his law firm, which allowed me then to really work on cases from the beginning to the end with really skilled trial lawyers, with Tom Hill, with who is now Judge Gallagher, who was just George Gallagher back then. But I was able to not only watch them on how they develop a case and how they develop theories on how they're going to present their cases to juries. I just figured out how I could shoehorn my way into their lives so that I could work on cases with them. And what I learned very quickly is that even after 5 or 6 years of practicing law, when I thought I was pretty good with juries, I did try a very famous high publicity murder trial with Jeff Kearney. And I realized early on that I had much yet to learn, even after 5 or 6 years of trying cases. And it was from him that I learned the importance of developing what your legal theory is. So that legal theory could be, well, my client did not do what he was actually charged with. It may not be squeaky clean, but my legal theory is that the state cannot prove exactly what they have charged my client with. And I learned that it is so important, especially in a jury trial, to know what your theory is, know how you're going to develop it, and to start selling that theory the minute that the panel walks into the room. That your jury selection is, it's far more important to be selling your theory than it is than it is really talking to the jury about other things. You need to be taking that opportunity to, in your questioning, to be letting the jury know what your theory is, because they will remember that theory in those questions. And then you tell that theory to the jury in your opening statement. Then, of course, you better be able to back that theory up with your presentation of your case. And in criminal cases, I learned very quickly that you typically have to build your case through cross-examination, that you don't have witnesses to bring. And so you best be ready to develop your theory through your cross-examination questions, which better be designed on developing your theory. That's how I learned that through very skilled mentors, that's how you win cases, is to develop your theory, make sure that jury is hearing that theory at every possible chance that you can. And I really learned my jury selection skills from trying cases with Jeff Kearney and with Tom Hill, for sure.
Yeah. And you've had a lot of cases, and I'm sure you've had some cases that really stick out in your mind as like seminal cases that kind of made an impact on your career. And I kind of want to talk about one of them. You had a CPS removal. And for those kind of unfamiliar with everything that's involved with the CPS removal, what typically happens when CPS requests for a legal removal of a kid?
Well, you know what, as you know, I'm not telling you anything, Austin, that you don't know, but what typically happens is that the prosecuting attorney, on day one, when CPS, when the investigators believe that they have sufficient facts to justify removal, the first gatekeeper for making that decision as to whether or not the facts legally justify the removal is the prosecutor. And I'm sure that daily you are presented, if not daily, several times a week, you're presented with that very scenario where CPS feels that children need to be protected, and here are the reasons. And you have to be the one that is skilled enough to analyze that very quickly, because a lawsuit has to be filed the very day that the decision is made to remove children from a dangerous environment, parents, and bring them into the more protective world of the foster care system, or maybe getting them with a relative. And so the initial stages of CPS litigation are pretty much ex parte. So you definitely need to have prosecutors who know what they are doing, who are honorable people, who look at those cases hard, because these are decisions that affect so many lives, not only the lives of the parents, and but obviously of the children and extended family members. So it's a very serious matter, certainly. And so that's how a CPS case starts. it starts out in an ex parte fashion in that it's the prosecutor presenting the case in an ex parte fashion to a judge. The judge is the next gatekeeper who has the opportunity to quickly take a look at the reasons for the removal in an affidavit format and make a decision as to whether or not the judge believes that there's enough evidence to justify getting those kids away from their parents. And then it's the system then moves very quickly away from the ex parte dynamic, and it's full blown adversarial. And Tarrant County, in my opinion, has a great system in place, which very quickly gets lawyers appointed if the family qualifies for appointed lawyers, and they usually do, as you're aware. The lawyers get to make the system as adversarial as it needs to be, very quickly. And as you and I know, that there is an adversarial hearing that by law is required to occur, which gives the parents an opportunity to disagree with the reasons for the removal and have their lawyers advocate for that and litigate for that in a contested hearing that we here in Tarrant County call the show cause hearing.
Right. And that show cause hearing has to happen essentially within 14 days of the removal, again, by law. So you had a case that came into your purview that was essentially was a request for removal. Tell us about that initial request.
Yeah. So the initial request on the particular case that I wanted to talk to you about, because it, by the way, is a case that always jumps to mind when anybody asks me, you know, what was the most important case that you have handled? What is the most interesting case? This one always jumps to my mind. And it actually also involves, Austin, those two mentors that I had happened to have developed a good relationship with for two decades. And it was Jeff Kearney and Tom Hill. And the particular facts of this case included a child that had been injured, which are, to me, the reason that CPS should be in existence, to help those kids that are in harm's way, physical harm's way. And in this particular case, a child that was, very young, about 4 months old, had been brought to Cook Children's Hospital and had a very small skull fracture. And skull fractures don't happen by osmosis on three-month-old children. They happen because some force was applied from somewhere or from somebody. And as a prosecutor, you're aware that those are the hardest to try, because little children, little three-month-olds, can't tell us what happened. And so you must look at the injuries to the child to see what do those injuries tell us. And on this particular case, what the injuries told us was that there was a skull fracture, a small one. And the decision had to be made. What do we have to do to protect that child? And so the decision was made that we need to remove that child from its parents. It was actually a twin. And so both of the children were removed because you can't leave children in a household where their skulls are being fractured, whether little fractures or big fractures. And so I was the prosecutor on that. I made the decision that the facts justified removing that child from harm's way. And that case was set for a contested show cause hearing, which is what we had been talking about. Now, I went through thoroughly all of the medical evidence, because remember, it's the medical evidence that speaks for the child, since the child can't tell us what happened. What I was able to develop after looking at the CPS investigation notes and looking at the information from Cook's Hospital, that this skull fracture was discovered by the father. And by the way, this father and mother otherwise looked like very good parents. They were stable. They appeared to be loving people. They both had jobs. They both had a supportive family. And so it was a head scratcher for sure. As I had mentioned to you, what was interesting to me was that this case started in the wee hours of the morning when it was time to feed the twins. And they were bottle-fed twins, and the parents were good parents. They helped each other out. On this particular feeding, the father was going to handle the feedings. And so he got one tw twin fed, and then he was in the process of feeding, bottle feeding the other twin. And he advised, he was honest in what he was telling. He said he was very sleepy, he was very tired, and he was in the rocking chair, as he always was, to feed the children. And he said all was well. He put the child down, but then he said that he noticed a something on that the last twin that he had fed, he noticed something on its head, and it concerned him. So he hollered out for his wife to come in, and he said, "I think something is wrong, with baby number two's head." And the mother looked at it and said, "I don't see anything. Go back. Let's go back to bed." And he said, "No, I'm not going to go back to bed." And the child wasn't even crying. And he said, "No, I think we really need to go get this checked out." And the mother said, "Let's just do that in the morning if you're really concerned." And he said, "No, I'm going to do it right now." And he said, "Let's go." And she said, "Well, okay, let's just hold on." He said, "Let me call my parents, the maternal grandparents. Let's at least get them over here to keep the other twin while we go to the hospital." And he said, "No, I don't think I'm going to wait for that. You wait for them. I'm going to the hospital." And that was just, to me, just highly unusual. He was obviously very much concerned over an injury that you couldn't even really see with your own eyes. He went ahead and took the child to the emergency room, and even the emergency room physician really couldn't see anything. He could see a spot on the child's head, and the doctor said, "I think it's going to be okay. Don't worry about it." And he said, "No, I want a I want an X-ray. I want a CT scan, whatever." And so this father was very interested in making sure that that child was okay. And I had, I've had two babies. I know how exhausted you can be when you're doing those nightly feedings. And I know that sometimes you fall asleep when you shouldn't be falling asleep. And I was thinking that that could well be what had happened in this situation. Now, once the father was insistent, the child was taken into Cook's Hospital for the X-ray, and that is where they did discover this very small skull fracture. Well, then of course the police are called, and as you're aware, that there's usually a detective, and then there's a CPS investigator. They start asking people questions. The father was saying, "I don't know what happened. I was feeding the child, everything was normal. Then I saw this spot on his head. I just don't know what happened." And that's not unusual for that for prosecutors to then have to decide, well, what do we do? The parents are saying they don't know what happened. We know that something happened, which is what justified the removal to begin with. I then started looking at the photographs of where the, because the detectives went back to the house. They took all kinds of photographs and measurements of from the crib to the ground. And I noticed that they had some very lovely stained floors. And I noticed that where the rocking chair was on a piece of carpet, a lovely piece of carpet, and it was right next to the concrete. And in my mind, I was thinking that, based on my own personal experience, that in all likelihood, there was a really good chance that he fell asleep, he dropped the child, he was freaking out, and he was going to do what was best for that baby. He was not going to wait till the next day. He got to the hospital as he was supposed to do. Now, the problem is we're then in the middle of it. We literally were in the middle of the contested show cause hearing, where I pulled Jeff Kearney, who was the criminal attorney for the father, into a room, and I said, "Here's what happened. Your client dropped the baby. He lied to the police and saying he didn't know what happened. And what we really need to do is get him polygraphed. And I came up with what I wanted the relevant questions to be on the polygraph. Jeff Kearney, of course, trusted me because of the mentoring relationship that he had had with me. And he said, "Well, James," and I also was insistent on the polygraph operator, that the go-to guy at that time was who I was going to insist on being used. And Jeff Kearney pulled out a polygraph. He had already done that, and that my version of events was what was proven by that. Well, it was proven to be true by the polygraph. I reached back out to the doctors at Cook Hospital. They concurred that that could very well have been what it was. As a matter of fact, Austin, the doctors had tried to convince him of that, saying, "Hey, it's okay if you accidentally dropped your child on the concrete floor," and he just could not bring himself to say that. So then I was in a real dilemma because we were in the middle of a show cause hearing. I was now aware that he had lied to the police, which is an offense. And so I told, and I had to kick Tom Hill, who was representing the mother, completely out of the room, because this was a discussion that was to be had just with the father, or the father's attorney. So then what I had to do was get a continuance on our show cause hearing, because what I then needed to do was do what I could to help this dad. I didn't feel like he needed to be criminally prosecuted. He had done the right thing as a father. He had not intentionally or even neglectfully, in my opinion, hurt the child. These things happen. They're called accidents. And so I thought, well, what can I do to make this situation as best as I could? So I got the show cause hearing stopped, reset for another day, and I went to the chief of the criminal division of the Tarrant County District Attorney's Office and laid out the whole scenario. And I said, I really think that what we need to do with this guy, if he will now come clean and admit to us all that that's what happened, what can we do about getting an agreement that we will not prosecute him for a false report to a police officer when he had told them, "I don't know what happened." And I was able to kind of play defense lawyer to some degree to seek justice. Of course, that's the job of a prosecutor, is to seek justice and not win cases. I was able to ensure and negotiate a deal that if he would come clean, that he would not be prosecuted for lying to the police, and that I would non-suit my CPS case, and this family could go on about the business. And I hoped that all would be well. Of course, then he had to face the toughest jury of all, and that was his wife and his in-laws, who apparently were very furious about him, about the whole thing, not about him dropping the child when he was asleep, but about not coming clean. And I tried to talk, and I did talk to Tom Hill, and I said, "Okay, now you've got the role, Tom, of helping out, and you've got to convince this family that he was doing nothing wrong, because he was the one who was insistent on getting that child to the hospital to make sure everything was okay." I think all parents have been there when something has happened to the child and you overreact and go to the hospital and you really didn't have to go at all, which probably would have been okay here because this child needed no medical attention whatsoever for the slight injury that he had. And so that is the case that just comes to my mind as the one of the most important cases that I handled, because I was listening to people, I was looking at the evidence. The evidence certainly supported me initially asking for the removal of that child, but I took a closer look at it, and because I had developed those important relationships with other people, I was able to kind of pull off what I thought was a successful conclusion to a trial, on a trial that initially looked bad. Kids need to be protected. I had done that, but then I went the extra mile to make sure that justice was served. And I never found out how he fared with his in-laws after that. The
Right.
in-laws who actually had to pay those high-priced lawyers to get from point A to point B. And I always laughed and thought, no, what they really needed was me. They didn't need Jeff Kearney. They didn't need Tom Hill. They just needed to have a prosecutor who was not bullet-headed and was able to listen to people and think. And so that is a case that kind of meshes all things together on the importance of having trial skills, building mentorships, being good at what you do.
And, you know, I think you hit the nail on the head a certain degree a little bit earlier when you said, you know, the job of the prosecutor is for dispensing justice. And sometimes young attorneys, young prosecutors get this mindset of like, we need to win, right? And especially on these kind of cases where it's a serious case, you know, you got skull fracture, you got you know, you only have one parent's version of the event, and no one really knows what's happening, how the injury happened initially. It kind of took you putting some, taking a step back, putting some evidence that you found, putting it together, and doing the right thing, which was not prosecuting it as hard as you could, but to, you know, find the solution that worked best for justice. And I think you did that.
And you can do that in whatever kind of cases that you're trying. It's not just criminal cases. It's not just CPS cases. It's in whatever kind of litigation that a young lawyer is working on. It is so important to be seeking the truth. And if you'll do that, you'll be seeking justice as well.
Well, that's a great case and a great story. This has been Austin Gardner with the Tarrant County Young Lawyers Association President's Podcast. I want to thank you for listening to our series on legal legends, war stories of Tarrant County attorneys. We hope you subscribe to our podcast and join us for future episodes. I want to thank our guest, James Steele, for joining us today. For more information on what's happening with our organization, please check out our website at www.tcyla.org. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time on a brand new episode of the TCYLA Presence Podcast. Have a great day.